early in the morning, Chicago music lovers start gathering in Grant Park for a free concert. With picnic lunches, they camp on the lawn in order to establish squatters' claims to good seats. For the Chicago Park Commission, cooperating with the Federation of Musicians, is presenting Wotan's Farewell from Wagner's Die Walküre, sung by the great American baritone Lawrence Tibbett.
All these festivals started in the 1930s, in the Depression, and the idea was that all people would come together and be part of a great city and hear some great music.
Park Commissioner James Petrillo, sponsor of the concert, is congratulated by Tibbett.
I personally would like to thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tibbett. I hope that in the very near future, that concerts like these in Grant Park will be played in every city in America.
So let's go back to the summer of 1958 and the Grant Park Music Festival with this description. Carting babies in blankets and bottles of champagne, 55,000 persons piled into Grant Park last night to hear the phenomenal young man who conquered Moscow with a piano keyboard. They rustled in Christmas Eve anticipation through the program's first half. Then sat in cathedral silence when Van Cliburn, the Texan whose fame was launched with a purse of rubles, sat down to play. He may be Texas' best-known expert since the Longhorns were driven north. In the crowd that spilled to Roosevelt Road were teenage worshippers of Presley. Just curious, they grinned. There were others who admitted they couldn't tell a fugue from a march or a callous from a boy tenor, but they drove in from Michigan and Indiana. They sat through a broiling afternoon sun to assure good seats, and they dined on sandwiches and fried chicken, partly, perhaps, as one matron put it, because that was quite a thing he did in Moscow. And then to jump back a couple decades earlier to the first years of the Grant Park Music Festival's history. Chicagoans streamed to Grant Park by the tens of thousands last night to make way for Lily Pons, the largest audience of her career. Here was music and a single voice, a calm night, and a sky of stars. To the east stretched the lake. Between it and the skyline, like a shining white cornucopia, pouring forth sound was the band shell and Lily Pons, with the blue-white light of the Lindbergh beacon cutting the deep blue sky above. It was, however, a crowd that must have come for music rather than for curiosity, for an intense silence fell upon it whenever Miss Pons, who most of them saw only as a tiny figure in misty white with something orange thrown about her, began to sing. He who talked or even whispered while her voice trilled forth, amplified by the public address system, was scorned into silence. For the first 10 minutes of the concert, the thousands standing behind the first standing rows were unable to see the band shell. But women's vanity came to their aid when a young girl fished a pocket mirror from her bag and held it up as a periscope. Others quickly imitated, and soon mirrors flashed forth from every hand.
Imagine if they had had pocket cigarette lighters back then. I think Lily Pons would have thought she was at a Bob Dylan concert. We've just heard the voice of Tony Macaluso. Tony wears many hats at the Grant Park Music Festival, but his official title is Director of Marketing and Patron Services, and he is the lead co-author and lead co-editor with two colleagues, and we'll come to that in a bit, of a remarkable new book about this remarkable free summer festival, and we'll take apart each of those words in a moment. Sounds of Chicago's Lakefront, a celebration of the Grant Park Music Festival, published for the 75th anniversary of the festival by Chicago's Books Press, and we'll tell you a bit later how you can get a copy of this book, which is chock full of photographs, anecdotes, history, and a lot of context, which I think is one of the things that has made readers and profile writers about the book and critics, reviewers of the book so excited about it, is that this is not just a souvenir pamphlet. You all decided to do a real history of the festival and its connection with Chicago, and you did it all in a very, very short span of time.
We did, about 6 months from beginning to end, although being a summer music festival, it made it a bit easier because we did have some staff time available. But there was just so much there in the archives and so much material.
Whose idea was this, and how did you go about putting the team together, and tell us about your two colleagues, lead colleagues on this project?
So it was a true collaborative effort. James W. Palermo, the festival's longtime artistic and general director, who has sadly left for Denver, for Colorado, he was a key impetus behind the project. And then Neil Sammers, a Chicago historian who's done about a dozen fascinating books on many aspects of Chicago history, came to us around the same time last fall. And then Julia Bachrach, the Park District historian, and as the festival's been long associated with the Park District, quickly became part of the conversation. And with some very strong support from Lois Weisberg, the Commissioner of Cultural Affairs, in November we got the green light and we were off and running on a mad dash to put a book together in time for the 75th season this summer.
And you succeeded admirably and remarkably, and we should say that just in that explanation of how this came together, we have some idea both of the history of the festival and also of the way that it currently exists and is overseen, because the festival will come back to exactly how it started, but it started with the Chicago Park District, or perhaps it was even the South Park Commission, or because
the parks had just joined
they had
together
just joined together and been mm-hmm. consolidated then mm-hmm. and the Chicago Federation of Musicians, and James Petrillo will come to that. And it then was managed by the Park District, although along the way the festival itself began to develop more and more as an entity. And then several years ago, the management became shared between the Department of Cultural Affairs, where Lois Weisberg has been commissioner just about as long as Mayor Daley has been mayor, and the Park District. And along the way, of course, too, we'll come to a little change in the geography of the city of Chicago 5 years ago, the opening of Millennium Park, and with that, the J. Pritzker Pavilion, and the way that transformed the city, the relationship of all of these entities, and of course, the Grant Park Music Festival. I don't want to say, and maybe you'll differ with me as the historian now of all of this, Tony, but I don't want to say that the band shell, the new band shell, the pavilion, transformed the festival, because that would make it sound as if the festival was not already quite something. I think it enhanced the festival. It reminded many more people that it existed, and it invited physically more people to come. But the festival itself, those transformations that it's gone through in terms of artistic leadership, in terms of public support, I think those were already underway and had been going on for some time. Is that fair?
Absolutely, I think so. I think Win Delacoma found the best metaphor for it that I've heard so far, which is the festival in a lot of ways was like a Michael Jordan playing on a beat-up inner-city basketball playground and had all the skills but not the venue to really show it off. But then moving into Millennium Park and the Pritzker Pavilion was a bit like making the leap from that inner-city play lot to an NBA basketball arena, and suddenly you could really see what was already there in this case.
That's an excellent observation. Win Delacoma, of course, until recently the longtime classical music critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, and something that Wynn also shares with a number of the other critics in Chicago and a number of other people interviewed in the book and who have participated in the history and growth of the festival, myself included in that. Wynn grew up going to concerts. If you're from Chicago, or from the Chicago area, or perhaps even from Milwaukee or Indiana, as that early quote that you read to us about Van Cliburn's appearance in 1958 pointed out, your first experience with classical symphonic music very probably was at the Grant Park Music Festival. And I can certainly well remember my grandparents taking us there, spreading out the picnic blanket, whether we were there for squatters' claims. That came a little later when we talk about some of the special events at the festival over the years. But it was just something you did. It was something. There wasn't even necessarily a desire to say, this is going to be good for you, or, okay, now we have to go to a classical music concert. It was this, oh, we're going to Grant Park. And some of it, too, I think, was the sense in those early days, I guess they were about the first 40-some years of the festival, that original band shell just made you feel as if you were going back in time to some great Hollywood Art Deco moment, because you were. It was from 1931.
Born in 1931, yeah. And sort of flourished during the Century of Progress exhibition, and then became the home to the festival in 1935. So
right, and all the way up through Sly and the Family Stone, famous incident there. but you know, you had the Field Museum behind you, you had the skyline behind that, and then of course there was a period where the quote temporary band shell went up, named for the founder of the festival at Petrillo, and we'll come back to that, and that all of that leading after many, many years to the Gehry designed and internationally acclaimed now pavilion. But let's walk through the history a bit. The other thing that's important to note here is that due to the Park District sponsorship, there was quite an archive available to you. Now, it wasn't all in one place, but fortunately, when people talk about why do we need governments and why do we need archives and why do we need to save things, well, if we don't save them, we have no idea what actually happened in the past. And fortunately, for all of its various twists and turns and politics and so on, the Park District did a pretty good job of saving a lot of the history of Grant Park.
We were extraordinarily lucky, and Julia Bachrach certainly, and then her predecessors have a lot to do with that. The archives of the Park District are fascinating and rich, and it helped us also expand the scope of the book beyond just the music into the evolution of Grant Park and the lakefront and all the other events that we've shared that space with over the years. But it's so interesting to remember, because as a 21st century music festival, it's easy to forget that this is really a WPA era product as much as the Lane Tech murals or those great travel guides that the WPA produced. But one of the very few things from the WPA that's really survived essentially in the same form and spirit that it was born with.
The WPA being the Works Progress Administration, a part of the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And maybe you can walk us through, Tony, how did it come about that the WPA people in Chicago, institutions in Chicago, got together to launch this concert program?
There was definitely a reawakened sense of the potential of the lakefront, I think starting with the World's Fair in 1933. But really it took one person to get the crucial elements going, and that was James C., C for Caesar, Petrillo, the head of the American Federation of Musicians, labor leader, and really one of the most colorful figures in Chicago history. I think he could hold his own along with Captain Streeter or many, many others in Chicago history. And Petrillo fixated on this idea in the early 30s really to try to fill two functions. I think first, in some ways, for him was to get work for his boys, as he called them, his musicians in Chicago. They weren't all male, but a majority were at the time. Key things that happened, the advent of sound film, 1929, meant that the number of Chicago movie theaters that had their own resident orchestras were suddenly no longer needing the services of musicians. So he fixated on this idea of trying to find a really popular, large-scale venue for to showcase musicians. And then secondly, of course, with the Depression in full swing, a tremendous number of Chicagoans who had a hunger for art and music but didn't have the means to pay for it. And Petrillo quite astutely realized that if he could get the Park District involved, it was going to make it a whole lot easier to do a large-scale concert series downtown. Now, again, the venue is here. Mayor Cermak was around for the inauguration of the band shell 4 years earlier. And Petrillo first got himself appointed to the Board of Commissioners of the Park District and then began to lobby his fellow commissioners, the mayor and so forth, to get a festival started. And essentially, he was given permission to give it a try in 1935 with the understanding that if the festival drew enough people, the Park District would lend its support fully behind it. But for the first year, the Federation had to supply some of the money, some of the funds, and do a lot of the publicity and the marketing. And it very, very quickly became evident that there was a tremendous hungering, and the audiences quickly grew into the tens of thousands, even 50,000 that first summer. And the Park District signed on by the end of the summer and said, we're in for the long haul. And 74 years later, 75 years later, they're still a key part of the festival.
2 points that come out of that, at least. One is based now on the history you've pulled together. Why do you think it has been not that the Park District decided to sign on because they saw what a success it was, and government was in the business of publicity in those days too because it was the biggest company around, and we're going through a lot of discussion and debate right now in this country about the role and the size of government and the role that it takes in our lives. Well, of course, this is kind of a replay of what was going on during the Roosevelt era. Why do you suppose it was then that the Park District continued for 74 years to be involved with this? When Jim Palermo first came to Chicago to take over the management of the festival, I think that was a time when almost every press release and every article would always say, the country's last remaining municipally supported free summer series of orchestral concerts open to the public. So obviously other programs did arise, but they didn't last. And what was it about Chicago that has kept it going?
That's a great question. By the way, we stopped using the last. Now we'll start referring to it as the first of a next wave, because maybe there'll be a whole renaissance of these sorts of things around the country. First of all, very quickly on, I think people, and this became clear from interviews, newspaper stories, felt an incredible sense of ownership of the festival. Within a decade or so, we're already bringing a second generation, and it really became one of the key ways of demonstrating a sort of civic pride in the city, of spending the summers out there. And then over time, in the 50s with Venetian Night, and then the fireworks, and then eventually the Taste of Chicago, you began to see more and more other sorts of big-scale gatherings downtown. But it was certainly a surprise doing the research for the book. I expected to find many points over the history when the festival was much closer to perishing, and when newspapers were maybe debating, is it worth keeping it going? Is the attendance what it needs to be? But strangely enough, I never found a moment where they really felt like the festival was in real peril of ceasing to get its funding and so forth. And that was an interesting surprise, that even in those rough years in the 70s and the 80s when downtown wasn't necessarily in its healthiest state as far as drawing large numbers of people.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it, that Chicago, which like every other big city, has not been great about keeping its physical history, although with the lakefront there's a pretty big exception there, but one that's taken a lot of struggle. But we've lost a lot of physical institutions, but we're still very, very big, perhaps, as a city of immigrants and ethnic groups and so on, and even what's left of our kind of old blue stocking elite. We're a city of traditions, and I think the idea that, what do you mean there wouldn't be a festival, that's just the kind of thing that wouldn't happen. Now, you can tear down a building, you can close a particular theater, but the idea that, hey, we're a town that has this festival, or we're a town that has street fairs, or we're a town that has storefront theaters, that's just something that people, it becomes a part of their identity when they become a part of Chicago. So maybe the reason is a simple one, just that we like change perhaps in physical aspects, but we don't like change in the way we go about the rhythm of our year here in the city.
Absolutely. And I think that working-class immigrant backbone to the city is certainly also a part of it, too. You see that with the descriptions of how people went about experiencing the concerts even. There's some way there's this continuity between how opera was listened to in Europe in the 19th century, where it really was something that transcended classes, maintained here.
You see that still, I think, in the attendance at the concerts, and you have some remarkable photos throughout the book, but this photo that is used on the back end papers here, and I think I might have read something on a website that your designers were actually able to magnify and enhance this photo somewhat, mm-hmm. so that we could more easily see what must be 30 or 40,000 people just in this little chunk, and every woman is wearing an amazing hat
yes.
and an amazing dress. You can see from looking at these people that they are from the Slavic countries or the Mediterranean countries. These are either the tired, poor, huddled masses or their children. And for them, coming out to hear a concert and coming out to hear an opera or coming out to hear something by a composer from their native country is an extremely important thing.
Absolutely. In this photo, you see the gigglers and the people who are looking rapt with attention and the occasional yawners and the people who are looking mystified. And it's just the range of faces alone and ways of reacting to the music that you wouldn't necessarily see in an indoor concert venue.
It's a sea of humanity, and it goes on and on and on. And I know if you've been in recent years, for example, when there's been an Italian theme or when there has been a music of Latin American countries theme, you will see people just turning out. And, of course, you'll see people just in the course of the regular concerts who come from every possible background. I was at a concert just a few weeks ago, we're talking now in mid-August, and a family came in and obviously had not been to the festival before. They were trying to get information from the ushers. It wasn't clear how much English they had, and they sat down, and from things we were able to figure out from things they said and the person I was with who knew some things about their region, these were Kosovar Albanians, and it was also then became clear they had just come from being sworn in as citizens. And they had their flags with them, and this sense of, well, now we're American citizens. We need to go to the concert at Grant Park. I mean, I had a tear in my eye, and I thought, where's Tony Macaluso? We need to get a photo of these people.
That's fantastic. If you put that in a Fellini film, you'd think it was a little bit too much.
Yeah,
it almost
exactly.
Seems like, but
exactly.
But it happens. It's great.
Let's hear a bit from Mr. Petrillo, and then we'll talk about him.
This will show you why we don't want any more canned music in the United States again. And if that gang out there can take it, we're going to give it to them, ain't we, Mr. President? Now let's we see where we go here.
If you want to get a sense of a can-do, do-it-yourself type person, James Caesar Petrillo there. Let's we see what we can do here. He is accompanied on the piano in that interesting rendition of Hail, Hail, the Gang's All Here by President Harry S. Truman, a meeting of the AFM, the American Federation of Musicians, the national union that Petrillo went on to head. And you hear him at the very beginning alluding to perhaps the single most of many controversial moves that he made throughout his very long career, and that was the ban on all recorded music. That is, Petrillo could not ban somebody from buying or selling recorded music, but he could ban his members from participating in any recordings, and that meant there was, for what, 2.5 years, no recorded music in North America?
In the early years of World War II as well.
And this was done, he felt, as a means of getting proper payment and proper rights for musicians. And funny, here we are in the end of the first decade of the 21st century debating how people should be compensated and how people should get their rights in the days of digital music transmission and technology.
No, he certainly had a sense of what mattered for musicians and their livelihood. And the degree to which he was a national figure is really astonishing. He appeared on the cover of Time magazine during that stretch in the 40s. Hundreds and hundreds of editorial cartoons depicted him. In fact, he quite avidly collected all the cartoons, particularly the negative ones, and he actually enjoyed showing off the collection of cartoons.
Is it mentioned in this book, or did I see it recently elsewhere, where Petrillo's name was so known in the popular culture that he'd show up in Warner Brothers cartoons and so on. And at one point, two of the characters are talking about the different animals around them, and somebody says, well, blah, 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 and that there's a bull there with two horns, and the other guy says, two horns, we better talk to Petrillo about that. Anything that involved employing musicians involved James Caesar Petrillo.
Had to go through Petrillo, exactly. And, you know, he grew up very working class in Chicago. He was born actually in 1892, so right before the Columbian Exposition. Started playing trumpet as an early teenager in bands all over the city, touring around, but found that he had, despite the recording there, maybe his true talent was less as a musician than as an organizer, and began to be tapped by the unions to help convince restaurants around the city to make sure that they were hiring union musicians to perform.
And he was sent into what was considered to be the toughest assignment, which was to go to Chinatown.
Yes.
Which was both bigger, and every Chinese restaurant in those days was also a nightclub. And you had, I mean, people, you know, Irving Berlin in New York started as a singing waiter in a Chinese restaurant. They were, you know, this was, if you go back to Cab Calloway, Betty Boop and all of that, it was a netherworld, sort of the way later Harlem and the Cotton Club became. And he was sent in to go organize and tell these Chinese nightclub restaurants that they had to have union musicians. And it was sort of like, yeah, throw the kid that way, we'll never see him again. And instead
he came out alive and succeeded. Yeah, so clearly, I mean, this was at 22 he became the president of the Chicago American Musicians Union, which is another union at the time. But as a 22-year-old, there he was leading the organization and continued to rise the ranks. And by the time the festival began, he was still at the time in his early 40s when the festival began in 1935.
We should point out some other aspects of Petrillo, though, of course, so that we can make sure that we keep the context here. The Chicago Federation of Musicians, over time, whether it was initially officially that way or otherwise, was a whites-only union.
Mm-hmm.
And many people blame Petrillo for the segregation. And interestingly, after he was president of the American Federation, my understanding is, whether it was to save his reputation or he had a change of heart or just the times had changed, he then headed up the committee within the union to bring all the locals that had been established of separately white and black and perhaps other musicians and bring them back together into a single union with a single set of locals.
And it really is a mystery, what you mentioned is what his motivation was. Was it truly a change of heart and so forth? But he did, yeah, make that transformation. And I have a good quote that gives a sense of his thinking, his strategies around the organizing of the festival in the first place. And this is from an interview that he gave some decades later. So these are Petrillo's words, though I can't – you heard a bit of his voice, so
yeah.
you can imagine it coming from his mouth.
Yeah. Please read it.
So I had a meeting of all the employees in Chicago who hired musicians, everybody. I told them what I was after. I told them, you're not doing me a favor, but I'd like you to go to the mayor and tell him what you think about me. If you want to, it's all right. If you don't want to, it's all right. If you think I'm a son of a bitch, okay, tell him. No strings. And this is about him getting appointed to the Park District so that he could start the festival. So some of them went to see Kelly, Mayor Kelly, and I figured they did a good job. Later I met the mayor at the Cubs game and asked him if he had reconsidered. No, he says, I'm loaded, in terms of the Board of Commissioners. You can't imagine how many people want to get on that board. It was mostly political, you see, and I had no political backer. But eventually he succeeded in getting appointed to the board and, like I say, very quickly managed to get his primary goal, the festival, started and approved.
You also get that sense of whether you liked him or hated him, he was very straightforward and he just
yes.
laid it out. You know, I need to get on that board and I need to get appointed and I need to, once I'm appointed, I'm going to tell you how it happened and then we're going to pull this string and we're going to turn that screw and we're going to make this happen.
And like clockwork, he got it done. And in fact, his old office, the former office, headquarters of the Chicago Federation of Musicians on Washington
right.
Street, 225 West Washington, he had bulletproof glass. He had both an outer office and an inner office with a very heavy metal door that could lock and seal himself in and so forth. And even today at the new headquarters of the Chicago Federation of Musicians in a very different world, they've kept some of those relics. The bulletproof glass is still proudly hung up on the wall to as a reminder of the days when Petrillo was running the union, and it was a perilous and very different world.
It was a rough and tumble time, and also, yeah, of course, there was another organized institution in Chicago that was quite strong, that was involved more in criminal activity. And there were various times where the unions were allied with the mafia. There were various times where they were in opposition. And all of that threaded in and out, along with the more open and whether above board or not politics of the city and of business in the city. So somehow from all of that cauldron came this wonderful festival. Let's talk a bit about the artistic history of the festival, Tony. Who were some of the early leaders of the festival, and how did that change? We're used now to having either a music director or a principal conductor. Was that a modern invention, or was that something that emerged over time?
Emerged fairly early on. The first decade of the festival, so from 1935 up through World War II, the festival really was a showcase for a lot of different orchestras and groups. So the CSO performed there quite regularly, a lot of touring groups, and they were performing concerts 5-6 nights a week, 100-120 performances a summer, a bit more than we do these days. But in 1944, things took a really important turn with the formation of the Grant Park Orchestra under Nikolai Malko. And so for the first time, you start to see a coherent body of musicians that are playing together all summer long, starting to shape a sound and identity, an artistic director, and really the structure that still exists by and large today, 60-some years later, began right at the end of the war in 44. And from there, you start to see a lot more thought and care about the programming as well. And I think fairly early on then, a real change in terms of wanting to program slightly newer, more challenging work, and also blend together different genres. So you start to see jazz at first, but then also dance within a decade or so becoming part of the festival. So a much more, let's say, carefully curated set of programs.
Another thing that happens in the 1940s, we've talked about the WPA, we've talked about the Depression, but the war has a even more direct impact locally or anywhere in the country in terms of athletics and in terms of professional music, because men are conscripted. Men are off in the war. And we know that Bill Veeck, with baseball teams that he owned, tried a number of things to bring amateurs and even what was then called a midget in to play baseball. In Chicago and in other cities, though, we had something a little more progressive than that. I'm thinking of the Chicago Woman Symphony.
And by most accounts, Time magazine had a long article about them at the time. It's considered probably the premier women's orchestra in the country, according to a lot of folks. And they performed quite regularly at the Grant Park Music Festival, starting fairly early on in the late 30s, in fact.
Were they able to consolidate any of that after the festival? The Chicago Symphony Orchestra had a number of women players and even women principals during the war, and most of them either were pushed out or voluntarily left after the war. Certainly the principals did, and then the men came back and took their seats. Do you have any sense of what the count of the Grant Park Orchestra was before and after World War II? Were the women able to keep any of those seats?
It certainly slipped as well. There were a few women who were playing. There was a woman cellist and several others that stayed with the orchestra into the later half of the 40s after the war. And then finally, much later, you start to see a much greater equity in terms of men and women in the orchestra.
And, of course, there was the effort each year to try to bring in a major star or a rising star. And these people ranged in the 1940s, at least, from Benny Goodman to Paul Robeson. I think Lauren Mazel made one of his earlier conducting appearances.
As an 11-year-old, there's a great photo of Lauren Mazel clutching the baton at 11 years old and got great reviews. And it's amazing to think that here he is.
1941.
Yeah, 67 years later, taking the New York Philharmonic to North Korea.
He looks like he's going to North Korea in this photo, actually, at age 11.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the great singers would come. There's always been a tradition of that, going back to Marian Anderson and Jan Peerce. It was Mario Lanza.
Mario Lanza came a number of times.
And there's always been this sense of this is the people's festival, and I think that that must also be an attraction for some of those guests to come here. Let's hear a little bit about an important piece of history of the festival and also the way it related then still to the festival in its modern day. You're listening to Critical Thinking, 98.7 WFMT Radio and WFMT.com, where you also can hear these programs online and experience the Critical Thinking podcast, WFMT.com/ one word, Critical Thinking. I'm Andrew Patner, and we're talking with Tony Macaluso from the Grant Park Music Festival about the new book, Sounds of Chicago's Lakefront, a celebration of the Grant Park Music Festival.
In 1958, I remember my father coming home from work one day, and this was after Van Cliburn had won the Moscow competition, and, you know, he was a huge celebrity, but I had never heard classical music before, and I don't think my parents had either. But my father came home from work, and he worked at the Park District, and he said, hey, Van Cliburn's going to come to Grant Park. I was 12 years old at the time, and Southside kid, you know, working class parents, and we came down, and this was the first time I had ever heard a symphony orchestra, and the first time I'd ever heard a professional pianist. And of course, I was studying piano, but I was studying with a neighborhood accordion teacher, and if you're on the South Side, you'll understand that. But anyway, I came down, and I was just absolutely knocked out. We sat up very close, and that night, I really fell in love with classical music.
I hear a lot of people talk about their introduction to classical music at Grant Park. A number of people approach me every year and say, gosh, I remember when I was a kid, my father used to bring us to the concerts. I think what makes the Grant Park Music Festival special is that you can walk in right off the street. You don't have to have a reservation. You don't have to have a reserve seat. We don't have a fancy hall. We don't have someone standing there taking a ticket. If you've never been to a classical music concert, you're not necessarily sure how to act. And at Grant Park, we've kind of relaxed those restrictions. You come in, you enjoy the concert, you listen to it on your own terms.
There's no more democratic place than Grant Park because it's free.
We'll be right back.
the All-American Music Festival, the Grant Park Music Festival, from its first released recording, Independence Eve at Grant Park with the Chicago Park District's Grant Park Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, as it was all called then. David Lobel conducting, recorded in 97 and 98, and Mary Stolper was away that year, so that's Mary Brown playing the piccolo, I believe, for Stars and Stripes Forever of John Philip Sousa. And before that, we heard some reminiscences and some observations from two great friends of the Grant Park Music Festival, Jack Zimmerman, now of the Lyric Opera of Chicago, whose wife Charlene Zimmerman is principal clarinet of the Grant Park Orchestra and of the Lyric Opera Orchestra, and Jim Palermo, James W. Palermo, the until recently artistic and general director of Grant Park, giving us a sense, but it taking us back to not only to that iconic performance, 1958, by Van Cliburn arriving here after his success in Moscow as the American winner of the Tchaikovsky competition in the midst of the Cold War, but coming to Chicago and giving performances with 100,000 people or more, again, to deal with continuity here, 36 years later, after a number of retirements and tentative returns to playing, Van Cliburn came back to Chicago. And I just want to read this paragraph here from the introduction to the book by Van Cliburn, because I was in that audience, and it was amazing for us as well as for him for reasons he describes. On the 12th of June, 1994, I performed with my friend Leonard Slatkin and the Grant Park Festival Orchestra. En route to the performance, I remarked to friends that I hoped there would be a few people who still remembered me and wanted to hear me play. The audience had an intimate ambiance, so concentrated and magnetically inspiring. The silence was palpable. I was overwhelmed. To my surprise and shock, the next day the newspaper reported there had been an audience estimated at 350,000. I said to myself, if that be true, Chicago is surely one of the greatest audiences in the world. And it be true. It was true, and it is true. When people then left the field, there was just this feeling, sort of the feeling you have if you've gone to some kind of a festival or a rock concert, of this camaraderie, except it was for classical music, and it was 350,000 people. They had to close. They weren't anticipating this. They had to close all the streets off during the concert so that when people left, they could actually have egress from Grant Park. And I think that kind of thing is a reminder of the power of a special event that is a special artistic and musical event as opposed to a commercial event or a particular holiday.
And even Barack Obama on election night didn't quite draw that many people. It was 250,000, 300,000, and that was a phenomenal crowd.
Some highlights maybe from the 50s and 60s, Tony.
And certainly the Van Cliburn performance in 1958, because again, it was a year, less than a year after Sputnik was launched, at a time when the country, the world, was really in this sense of tremendous anxiety. There were plans to build an immense bomb shelter in Grant Park, not very far away from the pavilion, in fact. And so the fact that it was not, you know, John Wayne, not the Lone Ranger who sort of provided the great answer to Sputnik in some sense, 6 months later, but this skinny 20-some-year-old from Texas mm-hmm. who became, for that year and many years since, really one of the great sources of pride in the country. And when he came to Chicago, phenomenal stories and pictures of him being greeted at the airport with convertibles packed full of Chicagoans dressed up like Texan cowgirls and driven in a ticker tape parade from Midway Airport downtown. And again, those phenomenal crowds that you hear about.
You had a couple of famous pianists in the early 1960s, Alfred Brendel and some kid named Barenboim,
who yeah. I don't know what he's been up to ever since yeah. that appearance.
There's
as a
wonderful photo here of Daniel Barenboim in 1964 when he would have been 21. He looks like a little child toreador, I guess you could say, the way he's standing there.
Great fire in his eyes.
In his white dinner jacket. And a very interesting review from Thomas Willis, the late Thomas Willis, father of Grant Park's engineer today, Christopher Willis, Grammy Award winner, and some of the very issues and criticisms that he has of Barenboim's playing 45 years ago are some of the same things that people say today. So that's quite interesting. And then a very serious picture, Alfred Brendel, who appeared in 1966 and 1967 at the festival. A lot of people associate the 1960s in Grant Park with the convention, with youth summers, with jazz and rock concerts. How was the festival itself affected, if at all, by the summer of 1968, 69, et cetera?
Well, really phenomenal. Another great example of how music and the larger history of the city overlap in terms of the festival. In 1968, the festival finished just about a week before the convention began in August of that year. But in fact, the last week or so of the season, they were doing Verdi's La Traviata, and already crowds had begun to gather in the south end of the park. And so there are some nice descriptions of the audiences coming to the concerts and the crowds gathering, getting ready, strategizing for the convention. As Noi Siamo Zingarelle is being sung from the stage, the Zingari, the gypsies of 1968, the protesters are getting ready for the conflicts. And actually the pavilion, the old Banjo, became really one of the meeting points in the south end of the park, right across the street, of course, from the Hilton, where many of the conventioners were staying. And the city, Mayor Daley, tried to really encourage the protesters to stay in the park, to not march to the Chicago Amphitheater at the time. But of course, the protests began their move towards the pavilion, and the clashes happened not long afterwards. The pavilion itself, the old band show, came away mostly unscathed. A couple of dozen smashed up wooden benches, but returned for another decade of service after 1969. But it really was a key meeting spot for the protests.
I think what we're going to have to do is have Tony come back and take us through the last 39 years of the festival, because I think if we want to play some more music, which we do, because that's what the festival is about, we're pretty much going to be out of time, and we've taken you only through bits and pieces, but chronologically about half of the history of Grant Park. I want to emphasize again the remarkable archival job of pulling photographs and identifying people in the photographs, which is as much work or more as finding some of these pictures must have been. And a large number of these photos have never been published before. Wonderful interviews and anecdotes shared by people who have had connections direct or by chance even with the festival. And even a full page, which we'll come to next time, and maybe we can actually have Mel come in and offer his own words, in his own words, but a full page on Mel Zelman, a very dapper, slender Mel in this photo from 1976. You will, of course, remember Mel as a long time and then senior announcer here at WFMT, and for 14 summers, he was also the voice of the Grant Park Music Festival from 1964 until 1977 in the old original band shell at the south end of Grant Park. A parting word or thought for part one, Tony, before we turn to a very exciting recording made by the current principal conductor of the Grant Park Orchestra, Carlos Calmar, with the orchestra.
I guess a good parting image is the fact that right from the beginning there had been dreams and fantasies about building a better band shell in the park, and almost every few years, several times a decade, you see plans emerging, discussed in the newspapers, and then they vanish for one reason or another. And I think where we're leaving off, the festival was just about to build its second home, the Petrillo. But I think the ideas, the impetus, and the dreams that eventually led to its third and current home were still very much present even back then in the wildest fantasies, though. But there was a sense that the festival, if all went right, had another level that it might move to, which I think we're at today with the new Pritzker Pavilion in Millennium Park.
Tony Macaluso, technically his title is Director of Marketing and Patron Services at the Grant Park Music Festival. You see him running around at concerts, making sure that all the patrons are taken care of and have found their proper seats. But he wears many hats and has done many, many things in his young life. And he is the lead author and editor of this wonderful new book. Chicago Books Press has brought it out. Sounds of Chicago's Lakefront, a celebration of the Grant Park Music Festival. We're going to go out now with one of the finest of many fine recordings and one of the most important by the Grant Park Orchestra. Robert Kurka, who was from the near western suburbs, I believe from Berwyn, and who died quite young in 1957. His Julius Caesar symphonic epilogue after Shakespeare, Opus 28 from 1955, existed in a very famous semi-pirated concert recording from the East Coast, but this was the world premiere recording of Chicago's own composer with Chicago's own orchestra, and Carlos Calmar presiding, recorded in 2002 at Orchestra Hall, Robert Kurka's Julius Caesar. Music of Robert Kurka, his 1955 Julius Caesar symphonic epilogue after Shakespeare, opus 28 of Robert Kurka, who would live only until 1957. Carlos Kalmar leading the world premiere recording, the Grant Park Orchestra, on a CD release from the early 2000s. We opened also with music of Carlos Kalmar and the Grant Park Orchestra, the second movement of Bartók's Two Portraits, Opus 5, from 1911, the presto distorted movement with the Grant Park Orchestra. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great, as he always does. We want to thank Tony Macaluso and Farah Malik from the Grant Park Music Festival for helping to put this together. We want to thank Sidney Gillard of WFMT and Chicago Tonight of WTTW 11 for some of the sound that we used today. Drop us a note. Let us know what you thought of this or any of our other programs. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. Visit us online, WFMT.com/Critical Thinking, where you can experience the Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.